Joe Chelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
February 8, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the show you were looking for. I know this because that's me tapping on my mic stand, and you hear it. Anyway, it is a Tuesday night. It is the second broadcast day of the week for the O'Chelly Effect, but that might not matter if you're catching it further on down the stream by your Fondle Slab of Choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour, because most people listen to the show via podcast anyway. But no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome to it. So this is going to be a sort of unique show, I think. Because, first of all, I don't normally have authors on Tuesdays for 2 hours, but that's what we're going to do. And an interesting author at that. Everybody knows, if you listen to this show regularly, that I have a special interest in the John F. Kennedy assassination, the saga, the research, the individuals. I've done research myself. Everybody always asks, where is a book? Well, maybe we'll get there next year, but regardless, I love to have the best, brightest, and most unique people I can have on the show to discuss things. So Bob Wilson, who does I'm Looking Through You on Sundays on the network, which I produce, introduced me to somebody who I've already actually met before. And I sort of shook hands with him and didn't know what to make of what it was he was doing, you know, because I heard he's the son of an interesting character in the case. I heard he's a smart man. I heard he's got a bunch of things to say about the case. And I said to myself, well, I don't know what to make of that exactly. That's the truth. Anyway, Bob Wilson made sure that a bit of an introduction was made between him and me. And I've been observing Michael Marcades for a bit. And I got to say that not only is his story interesting as far as the JFK case goes, but quite frankly, it makes sense that we discuss something like this, even if his mother was not related to the Kennedy assassination. You know what? This would be a story to talk about from what I call the invisible parts of America. So there's some things I might actually have in common with Mr. Marcades. Our mothers might have been engaged in similar occupations, although decades apart, maybe. But you know what? The result is the same. It's an interesting story in and of itself, again, even outside of the JFK assassination. But if you are somebody who is familiar, you might remember in the Oliver Stone movie that the actress who played Hot Lips Houlihan in the movie MASH portrayed this interesting woman who was kind of tossed out on the side of the road in a dress, screaming and yelling that they were going to kill Kennedy. She was talking about this ahead of time, and this is in the opening rush of the movie. And later on in the movie, you get told by different characters voicing things that she was actually a whore and a dope runner, and she had worked for Jack Ruby. Nobody believed her. That was Rose Sherman. Now, I know I just used a couple of harsh descriptor words, but Michael Marcades is well aware of the story, warts and all, and has spent a lot of time actually following up and finding out about his mother's life. And he's the author of a book, which is Rose Sherman, Gathering Fallen Petals. And if you take a look at the cover, it's really interesting. Online, it doesn't look as good as it does in person because I'm holding a copy in my hand here. It's well illustrated, annotated. Well, I didn't mean to say annotated, but there's documents are in this book. There is a lot here, and I only got it yesterday. But I started looking through it, and even the cover is very cool, which I was telling Michael before we went to air. So enough out of me. We're going to talk to Michael Marcades. We're going to get a bit of a snapshot that you could get from this book, except you're going to get a snapshot on my show. But if you want the whole picture, you may have to get the second edition indeed of Michael Marcades' book, and I'm going to tell you where to get it before we're done tonight. So anyway, enough out of my mouth. Michael Marcades, first of all, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Hey, Chuck, I'm doing great. It's certainly a pleasure to be with you. It's been a long day. I've been thinking about being on your show during my work day, and I'm ready to rock and roll. So thanks for the invitation.
Listen, a pleasure. As I said, I didn't know what to make of exactly what is it that Rose Sheremy's son could tell us about, honestly, when I first sort of encountered you. And I said to myself, well, that's interesting, and unless he was there, what has he got to tell us? Well, it turns out that my first impression was quite wrong, and you spent a long time discovering a whole bunch of things, not only about, well, your family, but about the circumstances that are, again, really interesting. If somebody has only ever seen the JFK film, maybe they have a mild curiosity about the case. They might know who Rose Sheremy is, but the problem is they don't actually know who Rose Sheremy is. And you wind up telling us a lot more about her in this book and refer to her as mother. Now, I got to be honest, I didn't have a warm relationship with my mother. And even though you were kind of disconnected from yours, it seems like you have a warmer sentiment towards your mom than I ever did. And I knew mine a lot longer, I think, than you knew yours. Again, not trying to compare notes here. It's just that I can relate to having to dig and delve into, well, a part of the world that, again, a lot of people don't even want to talk about. So let's begin this way. Let's just say you're somebody who's only familiar with Rose Sheremy through that piece there. Like I said, Helen, I forget what her name is, but she plays your mom in the movie JFK in that brief rush, and in some other scenes where she's in the hospital and she's crying out and she's saying they're going to kill Kennedy. And the story I always understood is that, you know, first of all, she was withdrawing from heroin. Oh, well, I forgot to mention that. Not only was she a dope runner and a prostitute, but was also a heroin addict. And again, I'm not saying these things to insult you. You yourself would assert this calmly and plainly because it's a matter of fact. But people didn't take her seriously at the time. And she becomes part of the legend and the lore. So why don't you pick us up from there if somebody has never really heard of your mom outside of maybe a mention from that initial rush in the movie, which again is followed up on later. And you get more descriptions about where she went and what might have happened to her, but nothing like what you've done in this book, obviously. So where would we take that for somebody who was just barely aware of who Rose Sheremy was?
Yeah, well, I understand that there can be a lot of confusion. And just to clear the air about talking about Rose Sheremy, my mom, I'm not squeamish about talking about anything related to her life and who she was, who she was connected to. I mean, it's just the plain truth. You know, I've just come to embrace the warts, as you say, and I'm not embarrassed by any of it. In fact, after all these years, I have spent about 35 years of my life in intense research about my mom, merely to get to know her. You know, it sounds like you were certainly around your mom a lot more than I was, but I was around a family who talked about her a lot. And but as far as those people out there who only know her from what's on that screen, you know, in fact, some people probably thought she was merely a composite character. But by the way, it was Sally Kirkland who played her. It wasn't that long ago that I had a chance to talk with Sally personally, and she uncovered a lot about her audition process and her talk with Oliver Stone about how important the character was. You know, but honestly, I was just as shocked to see Mother's character on the screen as others, you know, and not to be redundant, but obviously some people thought maybe the character was made up, but I assure you she's completely human.
Well, right. I mean, and that was part of my point, which I said Helen something there. But, yeah, Sally Kirkland, I'm pretty sure, actually played Houlihan in the movie MASH.
Right.
Pretty sure. So I had that part right. I just couldn't remember her name.
But, yeah, it's understandable.
Yeah, but the thing is, to me, that's not the important part. She does represent an incident there in that rush, and it's just one incident.
Right.
But it is based on truth. It's not necessarily, you know, look, again, Oliver Stone didn't make a documentary either. He used some very real facts, though, to construct that script. And one of those real facts happens to be the existence of this woman who became known as Rose Sheremy. However, let's begin from the beginning. Okay. You know, first of all, that's not the name she was born with. And people that are involved in that kind of business often have, guess what, aliases. Very sure that in order to reconstruct certain things that happened in your mother's life, you had to weave through legitimate aliases that were connected to your mother who was born under a different name. And you give her full name and actually show. I've seen the images of where the grave marker is and some other things there. She might have had multiple names in the course of her life. And Rose Sheremy was one of them. So maybe you could clear that up, first of all, because, look, the son is named Michael Marcades. Why is he named Marcades? Whose name is that? You might want to reveal that a little bit here just to give people an idea of what it is you had to unravel just to start with, regardless of whether your family talked about something or not, chasing it down and actually finding documents and being able to follow trails is yet another thing. So could you give us an idea what that was like and reconcile the name Rose Sheremy and like I talked about with the aliases here with for people, please?
Yes. Well, just to clear the air, my mother's full name is Melba Christine Youngblood Marcades. And, of course, her maiden name is Youngblood. And Marcades is the name of my father, whom my mother met when she was working at a very famous men's entertainment club in New Orleans called the Blue Angel. But the whole process of studying mother's life really has hinged upon me being able to put my hands on legitimate documentation. I mean, I certainly wasn't interested in making up any kind of story at all. I wanted to get down to the nitty-gritty, so to speak, bare facts, and I assure you that the documents that are in the book that you're holding, it's just a small representation of the dozens and dozens of documents that I've procured over the 30 years of research or so. But it's really curious that my research started with a couple of old, somewhat tattered, regular paper grocery sacks. When my maternal grandparents, my Rose Sheremy's parents, when they were both deceased, my extended family, one of my aunts, put in my hands a couple of tattered grocery sacks. And I had no idea how important the materials would become in my life. But in those sacks were everything from death certificates to handwritten letters, to pictures, to all sorts of tax documents. I mean, I could go on and on. But that collection of documents in those two grocery sacks actually served as the foundation for my research. And I must admit and say a word of appreciation to Texas Tech University for allowing me to pursue a PhD at the school and teaching me how to research. Some of those skills have really paid off. And, you know, over the years, I've told people, I said, look, this is not a book. It's a book report telling about things that other people have piled onto the internet. It's legitimate research. I've traveled across the country to various locations. I've spoken with people. I mean, I feel like I've paid the price. But in relation to the aliases, Mother had somewhere between 12 and 15 aliases. I mean, there's at least a dozen aliases listed on her rap sheet, mm-hmm. which is about 5 pages long. I mean, she was arrested so many times under different assumed names, obviously to protect herself, but certainly to also protect me and my extended family. I mean, she was around some bad dudes for a lot of her life. And they wouldn't have thought twice about harming my family.
Right. So this is a key thing to understand. And somebody might say, well, that's, you know, a wild story. But this is the truth of the way somebody lives when you're dealing with people that, quite frankly, know that they're handling the business of those that are vulnerable. And the fact is that, you know, somebody disappearing, especially during the time your mom was active, you know, would not have been a big deal in a lot of places. And your mom was literally in some of those places. So, you know, the use of aliases and trying to avoid getting connected to, well, the wrong bosses you might have been working for at the time or anything else, this is all just part of the natural way of things, again, in that part of America that a lot of people don't want to even acknowledge exists. And still exists to this day, by the way. It's not something that went around and disappeared in the 1960s or the 40s or the 50s or, you know what I'm saying? In different eras, it takes on different forms. But this is exactly. Just part of the business. You know, my mother was active in the 70s and 80s doing the same thing that your mother was doing. The difference here is that, and I want to talk about this story too, because you talked about what was handed over to you by your grandparents effectively, but through your aunt. And they were just sort of the keepers probably of the family records, so to speak. And so it was passed on to you, or at least part of it was. And they might have kept everybody's birth certificates and everybody's information, so to speak. But that was about family. And here's the thing about your family story, too. And something that people need to understand is you were only around your mother until you were about, what, 5 years old, I'd say, right?
That's correct. I tell a tale in the book about my grandparents who were mainline Christians and, you know, followed the lead of God. And I tell the tale about my grandmother telling my grandfather one day, look, I'm worried about where Crit is. That's what they called Christine. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about where Crit is, and I'm worried about what Michael's having to deal with. And they literally hopped in their car and drove to Houston, Texas. And the tale, I don't know if you want to go into it now, but I was abandoned, left in an apartment, a filthy apartment with, you know, just insects on the floor and absurdities, squibbles on mother's door that you went into. They literally stumbled onto her into Houston, which wasn't exactly the center of Christianity at the time in the 50s. Houston was a tough, rough place, mm-hmm. all kinds of crime, all of this stuff going on, you know, on the back roads that most of us never travel, of course.
Right.
But it was there. I mean, heck, it's there on the streets today. We just don't see it. I don't know, but anyway, my grandparents were in their car. They literally stumbled onto my mother plying her trade on a quarter street in the seedy part of Houston. Mother runs over to the car, hops in the car. They barely exchange hellos and say, look, I've got to take you to Michael. And she directs them to her dilapidated apartment. And there I am, four and a half years old on the floor. I'd been left alone completely while mother was doing the business of her bosses who didn't really care that she had a child.
Right.
And, you know, that's the day my grandparents took me home, and mother identified with them that day. They said, look, according to my grandparents, she said, look, I can't do this. You got to take him home with you.
Right. Well, see, now there's an interesting point of parallel where I'm just going to explain here, and I'm not going to do this the whole show, trying to compare myself to you at all, but here's where we diverge. Ready? So I didn't realize it was 4.5. I thought it was about 5, and honestly, I must, you know, I probably would see that detail in the book, and this would be a much more detailed story in there if you guys were to pick it up and get it, just so you know. But here's the reality for me. At the age of 4.5 also, my mother was a bit of a junkie and kind of a stay-at-home mom, but she was disastrous at it. My father pretty much took care of me. But he committed suicide when I was 4.5. So at that point in time, my adventure into getting abandoned places and getting put on bar stools in dark corners and getting left in parking lots and stuff like that starts then. instead of ending then. So you might not have all that many memories. I don't know. A lot of people don't have great memories previous to that age. But I certainly remembered that turning point in my life. Everything changed. And I was full on. Either I was a hindrance or I had to be useful in the trades. So my life went differently. My life went in the direction that yours was absolutely stopped at exactly the same age, where, you know, you would have been exposed to further things, and she might have done her best to protect you or to teach you how to survive in the environment, and all that. But for the betterment of your soul, my friend, you did not have to endure it. So it's an interesting part of it, but now this puts you away from your mother. And for her part, it's probably, and I think you describe it in here, that that she felt that was a good thing for your safety. And that's just the way things went. But then you grow up with your grandparents. And as you said, they were strong Christians, and you spoke on another program on this network about how, you know, look, they were a bit strict and all that, but you were, you know, well cared for, and you went on with your life. Now, at what point does mother come back in, or does she ever come back in for you personally?
Well, she never comes back in for me personally, and she very seldom comes back at occasions. You know, memories are strange things. I have so many pictures, and I have, you know, quite a few pictures of my being with my mother. Some I remember the event, some I do not remember the event. And, you know, I was really, honestly, looking back as an adult, you know, I was really grateful to have the protection of my grandparents and my extended family, because, you know, in those four, you know, I say 4.5 years because it was sometime right before the time I went to first grade, and I went to a nursery for about a year before I went into school, so that puts me about 5 years old. I do know that mother was very active in her work with the mob, drug runs and prostitution runs, and she was always depositing. I started to use the word dumping me in various locations. Sometimes she would dump me in New Orleans with my father's mother, my grandmother Guidry. Sometimes she'd take me to her parents. Sometimes she'd drop me off at friends. I mean, I was deposited everywhere. And I just think she just figured out she couldn't keep dragging me around. And, you know, oddly, I don't really think of my mother as being a bad mother. Even after all of the discovery of horrible things that she was involved in, I think she was a woman who had to figure out how to survive. She wound up with a child. My goodness, she was married, as if discovered last week with the help of a friend, another marriage that I didn't even have on my docket. So that means she was married 5 times, yet I'm the only child that she gave birth to, you know. So apparently she knew how to stay out of trouble most of the time. But you know, mother did come and go.
Right.
The sad thing and the odd thing about that is my grandparents almost never knew where she was at any given time. Neither did my extended family.
Right.
And that was pretty painful for them. I mean, mother would literally show up out of the blue. I remember one incident where we were living outside of Duncanville, Texas, in a very unusual neighborhood that I've come to understand as a neighborhood that was actually made up of a lot of people who were connected to the mob. It was somewhat of a protected neighborhood. I would never have guessed that in my life. But I discovered that through talking with some friends that I had down the street that are now grown adults. And, you know, when you become adults, things come out a little bit easier. But anyway, you know, mother showed up in a yellow cab. You know, I remember being scared that she had actually arrived on the scene, because, you know, my grandparents had said, look, Mike, if you ever see your mother somewhere, don't ever let her take you with you, with her. You know, so, you know, I was kind of instilled in me that I needed to keep my distance, you know, although as her young son, you know, there was that nag of wanting to be close to her, wanting to be hugged by her. And yet when I was with her, there was always this little nagging bit of fear.
Yeah, no, that's definitely interesting, because they were kind of keeping you from her. I mean, did you understand what the agreement was there? Because, again, according to your original story, it seemed like she was all for, yeah, take him. And maybe she thought that was temporary and at some point she was going to come back for you. I mean, is that the sense you got from it, but you were shielded from some of this?
Absolutely. I was shielded from a lot of this. You know, my family just, you know, I'm not proud to say that our family didn't talk a lot about this. Although I did, over the years as I got older, I got a lot of snippets of important information from them. But by the time I was old enough to understand what was going on, my family had been through so much pain in trying to deal with their sister and their daughter. You know, and my aunt's husbands had rescued my mother from jail and other circumstances so many times. You know, so in some ways, I think they literally thought they were helping me by not talking about it. But as I look back, it really, really wasn't the best thing for me. But, you know, I've just discovered so many things on my own that I wish my family had told me. But she would show, and then just as quickly and mysteriously as she arrived, she'd be gone. In fact, I don't even remember her departure. My guess is she probably left when I was asleep. I don't remember her telling me goodbye or hugging me or kissing me on the cheek or anything like that. And then I remember an Easter Sunday, taking a picture by her side. I just remember how beautiful she looked. And then, of course, I remember her funeral, which was very odd, you know, for me. There my mother was in the casket. And I really didn't know her like most sons knew their mothers. Mm-hmm. And so it was just an odd situation. But those are the main times that I remember actually being around her.
No, fair enough. And also, you know, the first question that jumped out, you know, from people that I talked to, a couple people said I was going to have you on the show. When they were vaguely familiar with your story and I started familiarizing them with the story that we were going to tell tonight, one of the first questions that came to their mind is, well, does he know who his father was, or, you know, did he ever find that out? Now, I know the answer to it, but I figured I would save it for tonight, because you had to track that down too, because we didn't hear about your father here in any of this story so far. Where is he? And the idea that some people had thought at one point that perhaps, and again, I'm not trying to be offensive here, but perhaps your father had been one of Rose's pimps at a certain point, you know, something like that. Can you tell people the real story on that, please?
Absolutely. Well, my father certainly wasn't a pimp or anything like that. He was an upstanding man. You know, he was in the Navy, had just gotten out of the Navy when he met my mother. And like most, you know, healthy males, you know, he loved looking at a beautiful woman. And he met mother or saw her work at the Blue Angel, as I told you, which is a very famous men's club on Bourbon Street. In fact, I've done a lot of research there, quite an experience going to the present day club. But everyone that I talked to, the managers, et cetera, knew well of the history about the Blue Angel. And so he met her there, and he immediately set out to, once he discovered that mother was, she may have been high on the list at the Blue Angel, but she still had very little in life as far in the ways of comforts and shelter and consistent food. And so he started taking care of her. He took her to what I refer to as the big long White House on Veterans Boulevard in New Orleans, and introduced her to his mother. And you have to understand now that even by this time, mother had quite a few arrests. She had already been prison at Angola State Prison, which was a horrible prison, by the time she was 19. So, I mean, the fact that my dad's mother received her into their house is quite a statement. But once, I mean, once she started staying at the house, they were obviously staying together in his bedroom. And next thing you know, she comes up pregnant. Dad insists that they get married. From what I know about that, mother was a little resistant to that. But then later, just she was in love with my dad, Edward Joseph Monacatus, of New Orleans, and actually of Metairie in Louisiana. They got married. But the time that I had with my dad, which I'll make reference to here in a second, he made clear to me that as much as he loved mother, mother was a handful. Right. I mean, she was already into drugs and alcohol. The combination of those two substances always did quite a trip on her. She became belligerent, difficult to handle. I mean, he told me, look, the day your mother finally broke a beer bottle on my head was the day I said I couldn't do it anymore. Okay. But I have a marriage certificate. I have personal conversation with my dad. When I was in my mid-30s, I guess I kind of went through a crisis where I said, I got to know who my father is. And I was able, with the help of several friends, to actually track him down in New Orleans. I'll never forget making a phone call, not actually to my dad, but to someone who I later discovered was one of my half-brothers. But I made a friend had written the name down on an envelope, you know, from the phone book. I guess some of your listeners will remember what a phone book is.
Yeah, but, maybe.
You know, it had my last name, and it had another name in front of it. It wasn't my father's name. Of course, I knew that from my birth certificate. So I remember looking at that crumpled envelope for about a week and then mustering up the courage to make a phone call, and I was so relieved that I disabled my message, and it wasn't too long that I got a phone call back from that individual who we started going through things we knew about our family. I'll never forget at that one point in the conversation where we discovered that I was indeed talking to my half brother. There were two other boys born to their family through my dad's second wife, with whom he stayed married for, you know, a very long time, 25, 30, 35 years or so. Mm-hmm. So I know who my father was. I know he was in the Navy. He was honorably discharged. I know he worked the rest of his life for the railroad system in New Orleans. And, I mean, literally spent his entire career working for the railroad for over 30 years. You know, the thing that I found odd was when I finally showed up at my dad's house. You know, I'll never forget meeting him in the airport. He was, he looked like he was almost embarrassed by my presence. So maybe he was scared. Mm. You know, I can understand that, because this is a man I hadn't had contact with for 38 years, at least 35, 34 years or so.
Yeah.
Never gotten a phone call from him. I do have in my possession a couple of letters from him, but basically there was no communication. And as you can imagine, as a son, after I had my own children, I could not imagine in my farthest dream about not ever being in contact with my children. So when I showed up in New Orleans and met my half-brothers and my father, as soon as we got to my dad's house, he drugged me into his bedroom and opened up a dresser drawer and pulled out the divorce papers. And he said, I want you to see on here why I haven't been in touch with you. And He said, my wife told me that one of these days you were going to show up at my front door, and here you are. He said, but the court, at the demand of your mother's family, forbade me from making contact with you for at all, that there was to be no contact. You know, and so that was actually good to know. That wasn't something that was reported to me by my family, which in the long run, it might have really helped me to know that.
Well, see, it may have. It may have. But let me tell you from experience that it may not have, because simply the fact that you know this from the divorce papers, right, doesn't necessarily mean that you know the whole story. Why is it that they wanted it that way? Okay, there might have been a whole, you know, bunch of reasons there that are not going to be preserved on court documents, stuff that they knew or stuff that they felt, you know, and honestly, to sit and try and question and reconstruct why it is adults made decisions about you when you were younger, it's a really tricky thing to do. I'll tell you how I know this. Like, my father was dead, as I told you, at an early age, but I wound up having to reconstruct and go back and investigate his death. And I spent about 40 years with the knowledge that I had a half-sister, but for certain reasons, there was to be no contact between us, and I only got to speak to her a couple of years ago over the phone. And, you know, she didn't know the story of what happened to my father. She was completely separated from my family, and her family had reasons, and my family had reasons for not pursuing finding out what happened to the only sibling I had, you know, and so on and so forth. And when you try and really honestly dig into that, there's a lot of answers that are only going to reside in some people's heads. And by the time you do that, some of those people are gone. And you don't have the ability to know all of their reasoning. And I got to be frank with you, the thing to do is to make peace with it, because you're not going to be able to change it even by knowing the exact reasoning for it. It could be that your dad at a certain point was the kind of guy that your grandparents felt should not be anywhere near you. And they might have had good reason for it. Now, you might think to yourself, well, I can't see the reason in the world that somebody wouldn't at least allow me to be in contact with my own children, but you are not your father. You know what I'm saying? And I had to make peace with that idea too, is that, you know, my father was a certain guy. He only lived to be 25 years old, and still there was an intricate web of things to unravel, just discovering what happened to him. But, you know, at the end of the day, at some point, we all as men have to understand that even though we are fathers, we are not our fathers, you know, and for better or worse sometimes. And so that's something to keep in mind there. And that's something I like to remind people of, because there's plenty of people that grew up not knowing who their father was, or being confused about it, or, you know, or at certain points maybe they were lied to about it and they thought that somebody was their father who wasn't. and at the end of the day, you know, you are the man you become, and you become the father that you wish to be if you have children. That is the best you can do with life. That's the way I see it anyway.
I really appreciate your commentary, Chuck. You know, it really doesn't matter the why. I mean, it was. And although I do believe that my family probably had some prejudices against my father, maybe they didn't know exactly who he was. They were from a Catholic background, and so, you know, I'm not necessarily proud to say that maybe as Southern Baptists at the time, maybe they thought that was the wrong path to go down. Who knows? Mm-hmm. They were Italian, you know, so... I do know that it was a different time. You know, I certainly hope that we've come down the road about not judging people by the color of their skin, but we're talking about the 50s, you know. So, I mean, whatever the reasons were.
No, and that's the other thing is that, yeah. No, and that's the other thing is that there are subcultural issues that come up here where, you know what, your parents might have been or your grandparents might have been opposed to religion. There's a whole controversy like that in my own family because, again, you're talking about Italians and Irish coming together, which is really natural in the northeast of the country at that time. But my parents, both being born in the 50s, were, you know, a little bit different from each other. I mean, one of them's this, you know, little Irish girl who's a troublemaker. And the other one is, you know, this Italian charmer there who, you know, winds up going to Vietnam and destroying himself through that process. But the fact is that, you know, you're talking about an actual culture clash that people wouldn't even consider today. But among the families, there might have been differences. I mean, it's just, it's one of the things that goes on. But either way, look, it's not even the major part of the story, but it's a good thing to know that you actually, you know, went and tracked this down. And, you know, and the reason why I felt compelled to bring this up is because you said you weren't sure if he was scared or if he was reluctant for certain reasons. It is difficult to know that even because many, many years later, right? You know, certain things will soften in your mind for memory's sake. Some things will become more vivid. You describe, you know, she breaks a beer bottle over his head. He says that's the end of that. You know, she might have been a very volatile woman. My mother was. Volatile woman, especially when we're talking about the mixture of alcohol and drugs. And even more especially when we're talking about the use of cocaine and alcohol. I liked my mother much better when she was shooting heroin. She was a lot easier to deal with. But when she got involved with cocaine and alcohol, she was a fireball. And I mean, you're talking about a woman who was standing about 5'5", 99 pounds, could take down men much larger than myself in fistfights. I mean, she was very volatile. You know, and the truth is, I respected her for that. I know that sounds crazy, maybe, but I'm just saying, in the environment I grew up in, it was like, you know, you didn't. People knew not to screw with her. And your mom might have been exactly that kind of person. So, you know,
I would be quick to agree with you. In fact, you know, my mother was quite petite. She was about 5'4", and probably didn't weigh a whole lot more than about 110 pounds or so. But when she mixed alcohol and heroin and other drugs into her system, she was a different person, a different force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
You know, and that shows up in a lot of her incarcerations. You know, even, you know, I know one incident where she was going so crazy from needing a heroin fix that in the jail cell, she, you know, stripped her clothes off and was scratching her skin and beating her head against the wall. I mean, we're talking about some odd behaviors, but, you know, I believe my mother was that interesting mixture of unbelievable beauty and sensuality, and then at certain times all hell could break loose, you know, just given the circumstances.
But that's the type of woman that would survive, again, doing business in the underworld. You know, you see plenty of the, you know, Lifetime movie of the week. Here's the prostitute who's the victim. And yes, indeed, in some ways, I promise you that your mother was a victim of circumstance at certain points. And I'm sure you saw evidence of that as you did your research. And again, good thing to stress that your research is not just, you know, clicking on things on the internet. You actually did research, which I always try and point out to people is a completely valuable and almost extinct form of putting things together, because hardly anybody who writes books anymore, honestly, and I don't mean to direct this at you because this isn't you, but there are plenty of people that I swear to you just, you know, have collected articles from the internet and now decide to write a book, and that's it.
You know, I just want to assure, and I appreciate your support, Chuck, and I want to encourage your listeners that that's certainly not the road that I've walked down. You know, I didn't just sit and click on Google and say, tell me what you know. Number one, because the internet, you know, can't be trusted, and it doesn't go deep enough, and there's not documents. You know, I'll never forget my first edition of the book was published by JFK Lancer. And, you know, the president of JFK Lancer, Deborah, insisted when we went through my book, I had to have documentation. I mean, real pieces of evidence,
right,
to support everything that I shared. Now, in my book, do I create dialogue and scene description? Of course, Mother didn't walk around with a tape recorder, but everything is based on documented evidence. You know, so, you know, I'm really proud of that. And, you know, Deborah Conway wasn't about to publish my book without it being genuine, provable research.
Right.
So, you know, I'm proud about that. And, but more importantly, I wanted to know the unabashed truth. And yes, some of it pretty ugly, but some of it's pretty beautiful, conversely. So, mm-hmm. you know, I have the big picture now, with a lot of detail, and, it's quite a story. It really is quite a story.
No, it certainly is. And believe me, I'm going to get out of this mode of really digging into this part of the story, because I'm just laying the groundwork for a bunch of things that that you actually are able to prove in your book that, quite frankly, other people have made assumptions about and have yeah. used not the best evidence, I would say, to come to certain conclusions. And they may have been right, but, I mean, in all honesty, in some cases they were guessing regarding yeah. Certain things that, you know, your mother becomes a nexus of sorts for a variety of characters here in the JFK assassination story. And I want to get to that in the next hour, honestly, because I want to finish this hour by you know, putting a real cap on this, where, you know, what Michael has in this book, there's a ton of documentation at the end, and the documentation's varied. I mean, I don't know if you printed the whole rap sheet in here. You know, and I don't even know if that's necessary, but you certainly represented that part of her life. You certainly showed the, you know, the documents to back up probably just about everything you just talked about, you know, in the first hour, with the exception of the meeting with your father. I'm not sure if you documented that in here, but almost everything else you got documented in here. So at some point we're going to have to get to how it is we're dealing with the famous incident at the Silver Slipper Lounge and exactly yeah. what that all means. But we got to put it in context here. And this is something that Michael has carefully done in the book, which, once again, is Rose Cherami, Gathering Fallen Petals. And it's mostly a grayscale look on the front of the book. If you're looking for it online, I urge you to get the second edition. Although the first edition, I'm sure, is plenty valuable, and if that's where you want to go, okay. But the second edition has been expanded. I like the photographs, the one section of photographs here, which is also visually interesting. Shows you some of the stuff Michael was talking about, by the way. You know, scenes where there are pictures of his mother. There's pictures of, I believe, his family. You know, there's pictures of some handwritten documents as well at the end there. I'm looking at the book while I'm talking, by the way, just so you guys know. And this is definitely, if you want to understand this story, this is the first place you need to start. Okay. It's just that simple. And so where should we leave people, though? I mean, we've kind of laid out the groundwork for, look, this is the real human being. This is who we're talking about. To you, that's Mother. To me, that's Rose Cherami. You know, and she's an interesting character, even without the JFK assassination connections. Okay, because yes. like I said, if you just delve into Invisible America, no offense, Michael, but there's probably 100,000 stories like Rose Cherami's, in a way, in one way or another.
Indeed. And I love your reference about the Invisible America. I mean, it's truly there, you know, and Mother's story is, yes, unique because it's connected to the Kennedy assassination, but her story isn't unique. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of women who have been surely caught up in this kind of web and being left with no choices. being fearful for their lives. I mean, it's a bigger story about a woman who had very few, her choices left her few options in life.
Well, and that begins with a description you have about, well, her childhood. Let's get honest about that before we close out the hour. Because, again, let's look at the whole person. You know, at some point, Rose Jeremy was a little girl. And she was, you know, growing up. And, well, something did hit her and did some neurological damage to her, very, very likely. And caused some things to be. Now, I don't know if I entirely agree with the prognosis that, you know, doctors gave to your grandparents at a certain point there, where, you know, look, this is the big issue with what happened to her, and this is what you're absolutely going to have to watch out for. The potential is there, and it seems to make sense for sure, but on the other hand, you know, if more awareness and more care had been taken earlier, which might have been just a symptom of the time period in which she suffered, you know, there might have been a whole different outcome to her life. And this begins with an illness as a child, does it not?
It does. And, you know, I understand what you're saying. And my guess is 99.5% of your listeners out there don't even know about this aspect of her life. But, you know, Melba Christine Youngblood grew up as a playful, kind of mischievous child. She was one of three children to Thomas Jefferson and Minnie Belle Youngblood, who were East Texas tenant farmers. They were poor. They were modest. You know, even at the end of their lives, my grandparents had very little in terms of monetary worth. I mean, they were worth a tremendous amount to me, but their children, and they raised their children in a really different time. You know, in the mother was born in 1923. I mean, in the 20s and the 30s, parents viewed their children as property. And you know, I know from my aunts and uncles that, man, they worked their rears off. You know, they had chores. They were out in the cotton fields. I mean, they did lots of hard work. And when they screwed up, the fact that my grandfather was somewhat swift with the belt, and I mean, he didn't hesitate to correct his children, you know, maybe even according to what they believed was in the Bible about, you know, correcting your kids, setting them on a better path. But in all of it, you know, mother was the different daughter. Her older sister, Grace, by the way, all three of the girls were very attractive. Grace was the older sister, prim and proper, you know, down the narrow road about doing what she's been asked to do. My mother's younger sister, Gladys Mozell, you know, a little bit more insecure maybe as a child, like most younger kids. And then there's mother right in the middle, you know, tempting her older and younger sister all the time to do things they probably shouldn't have been doing. But nevertheless, mother was full of risk. I mean, there was nothing that she wouldn't head out and do. She had a way with animals. She was artistic. One of those grocery sacks that I mentioned earlier in the show, I uncovered a piece of artwork done by mother as a young child, and it is stunning. The mystery. It's a chalk, multicolored chalk rendering of a river with a small house and a moon coming up over the house. I mean, as an adult who has studied art, I mean, I read so much into that piece of art about who she was as a young child. But anyway, something tragic that you referred to happened to her when she was about 12 years old. She contracted an acute case of encephalitis. And I remember the first time I read that and heard about that, I went, what in the world is that? And so it encephalitis is an inflammation of the active tissues of the brain, and the inflammation is caused by some rogue infection or autoimmune response. And what happens when a child has encephalitis, or indeed anyone, the brain swells, and there's all kinds of symptoms that follow, you know, headaches, mental confusion, et cetera, and prolonged fever. Well, mother at the age of 12, she contracts this acute case of encephalitis. She's hospitalized for 30 days in Dallas. She has fever, and finally it breaks, and the physician sending her made the decision to send her home, you know, of course, with her parents, but not before they set them down and say, look, we were able to get your daughter over this hump. I mean, it's my understanding that some people actually died from encephalitis in the 20s.
Yeah, they did.
You know, in the early 30s. So, but they mainly warned my grandparents that mother's adolescent period could be quite volatile, and they should be on the lookout for any shifts in her nature and associated behaviors. And the thing that really caught me was my grandparents relayed to me that they were told at all costs, keep her away from alcohol and drugs. And of course, that's the one thing that mother seemed the siren, if you will, the one siren that mother seemed to run toward as she grew into her teenage years. But you know, that is not the reason that she led a difficult life, but it probably is an interesting contributing factor. I certainly don't look back at her contracting encephalitis and go, aha, that's the reason her life is the way it was. Right. I mean, it's just a very interesting, true medical fact to consider.
Well, no, and look, in reality, the knowledge that people would have about neuroscience at that point would likely only extend to the idea that, look, some damage is, I mean, let's just be frank here, some damage is going to be done to the brain due to the inflammation. This could change the person's personality. And at that point, they had already seen cases where people's personalities really did shift into, you know, more difficult traits as opposed to what they may have been previous. And this kind of thing does happen when, just let's be frank again, damage to the brain. You know,
absolutely.
Look, you see personality changes in NFL players today after, you know, significant repeated blows to the head.
You know, well taken, Joe.
So, I mean, I'm just saying, contributing factor, undeniable. The factor, though, I would say, yeah, absolutely, I agree with you. That's exactly where it would have to come down. There's a set of circumstances that comes together that, quite frankly, even in our modern day here, are not fully understood, that create certain personality patterns, because if they could understand it, they would take care of it. And obviously, there are many people who suffer from various behavioral issues in their lives due to cognitive damage. So, I mean, it is just, it is as it is. And as somebody who has, you know, suffered from multiple concussions in their life, I can tell you, it can alter you, and it does things to you. And I promise you, it's a factor. No matter what you do, it is a factor.
Exactly.
They've never figured out how to heal it.
I certainly don't believe this turned her into an incompetent, incapable individual. I mean, quite the opposite. I mean, she was quite capable, had a solid brain on her as far as processing and thinking. Of course, like all of us, she made some bad decisions. I believe I've made a couple of bad decisions in my lifetime, you know, so that's certainly not unique. But it is interesting to note that she contracted this at a time when, you know, in 2022, we think we have all the medical answers to anything and everything that arises.
Right.
Certainly not the case in the 20s and the 30s.
Right. But even today, I would tell you that at a certain point, medical science looks at you and says, sorry, we don't know what to do. And that's just the reality when it comes to stuff like this, where the brain is indeed impacted. So, I mean, it's just a clear reality. So, and again, I'm not saying this that she was incompetent or anything like that either. Matter of fact, some damage will make you more competent in the criminal world. There are people that, you know, quite frankly, there are certain emotions that are just not engaged in as well because of certain brain damage. And quite frankly, it becomes an advantage because you don't have the same empathy. So you don't mind when you got to hurt somebody, or you don't mind that what you're doing is doing some damage to somebody. Maybe it doesn't bother you at all. You're free of guilt, even some people, when they're injured in certain ways. And I'm not saying your mother was one of those. I'm just pointing it out as an example that it could have actually indeed contributed to her being more proficient at certain things.
Interesting. Or even I hadn't actually thought about it that way. So I really appreciate that insight.
Yeah, I mean, even the disconnection, let's just, you know, again, I'm not being rude here, but the disconnection from the idea that sex is merely transactional. If a certain part of the brain is damaged, that becomes just a matter of fact. It's no big deal. It's like as if you had a cup of coffee. It has the same emotional impact.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying it's a possibility here. I'm not claiming to know your mother's neurology. I'm just saying that there are many possibilities with this. So it's one thing to keep in mind. Anyway, we're going to get deeper into the story and actually go into directly the connections to the JFK assassination in the next hour as we continue with Michael Markatis, who is the, and I'm not even sure if I'm saying your name right, Michael, honestly. I know that's how people pronounce it, but I'm wondering if that's
Michael Markatis.
Markatis. Okay, I am pronouncing it correctly. It's good on me this time.
Well, if you were talking to my brothers, they would ask you to say Markatis. I mean, that's one of the things I discovered when I found them. But by that time, I'd been saying Markatis for 50 years, 38 years. So I wasn't able to make that shift. But no, Markatis, Markatis, yeah, whatever, works just fine.
No problem. The only reason why I doubted it is because I'm Sicilian, so I know that name could be pronounced a different way.
But
fair enough. If you're happy with Markatis, I'm happy with Markatis. And I got to tell you that this book, Rose Sheremy, okay, this is the name of the book again, guys, Rose Sheremy, Gathering Fallen Petals. The second edition is what I want to point you to. I mean, obviously, if you encounter the first and you feel like picking that up, that's fine by me. But I'm very sure that I'm going to give you links with the show notes so that you can pick up the second edition, which is much expanded. And maybe in the next hour, as we get into the JFK assassination story, I'll also ask Michael, what is the difference between the first and second edition? And tell us why that happened. But anyway, stick around. The Ocelli Effect will continue after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success.
This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. And you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson. With new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson. Ocelli.com.
When a fan of the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sicilian and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. Most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Shelly.com.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now. Hold on a second. Accidentally played an extra ad there. I'll just back that up, get that out of there. Anyway, second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins actually now. So, minor mistake at the beginning of the hour from me, trying to produce my own show. Michael Marcades is my guest, and he is the author of Rose Sheremy, Gathering Fallen Petals. And what is this a story about? His mother, first of all, foremost, but a character you would be interested in, you the listener, that is, for a variety of reasons, but this hour we're going to get to the primary reason. Which is that she is depicted in the movie JFK, and I inaccurately applied the actress there, her name. Not only that, but I'm keep trying to combine Sally Kirkland and Sally Kellerman into one person. I guess it's because they were both, pretty blonde ladies when I was younger. And there was a pretty lady in the movie JFK who was tossed out on the side of the road and then later shown in a black and white rush in a hospital saying that some pretty serious guys, I am paraphrasing for radio here, were going to kill Kennedy. And when was she doing this? Ahead of the time of the assassination. But there's a lot more to the story, and again, you can learn it through her son, who is actually the author of that book, Michael Marcades. And we're going to talk now about the JFK assassination. How do we get from all that groundwork, all that context we laid in the first hour, Well, you know, a lady who's had an interesting life, who has lived in, the invisible part of America, where indeed a lot of business is done. A lot of what people would flippantly just call criminal activity, but really is a subculture and really below the skin of what most people want to show the rest of the world when it comes to the American character. But I assure you that it is people like Rose Sheremy. It is people like myself at one point. It is people like Michael Marcades, who up until the age of four and a half or so was immersed in that part of the world that, yeah, most people would probably want to ignore intentionally. But it does exist. It is real. And indeed, sometimes gets you in touch with some really interesting characters. This happened to Rose Sheremy, Michael's mom. And maybe we could begin by, well, you know, let's go with the basic description from the JFK movie later when the Garrison office is discussing Rose Sheremy. And they say, well, she was a whore. She was a dope addict. And she was screaming out all beforehand. Nobody believed her. You know, nobody's going to listen to her. And I do remember at another part in the movie, maybe at exactly that part, the character played by Kevin Costner, who is Jim Garrison, says, you know, it always is remarkable to me that because a woman's a prostitute, she has to have bad eyesight, you know, and all that. And it's interesting context, but let's now go to the real story about that. So, blunt question, Michael Marcades, your mom worked for Jack Ruby. How do we know that this is true? Because, well, let's be frank, a lot of straight-up documentation on that would be difficult to get if all you're doing is clicking around on Google, for sure. And a lot of people have speculated, but didn't necessarily have the proof of it. So, challenge to you, I guess, how do you even prove that your mom was indeed a dope owner that may have been working for Jack Ruby?
Well, first of all, as I said in the first half, I haven't claimed anything that I don't have documents to support. I mean, I probably have 8 inches worth of notebook documentation that confirms that my mother, as Rose Sheremy, certainly knew Jack Ruby and that she worked for him out of the Carousel Club and also another club called the Pink Door. And, you know, I don't, she also was acquainted with other people. I mean, she knew, recognized Oswald, according to the document, or worked with him at all, but she knew him from his presence in the Carousel Club. You know, it's funny, it wasn't that long ago, after I had spoken at one of the JFK Lancer conferences, I received a call and an email from a former Department of Justice lawyer asking me the very same question. At the time, he was in the middle of producing a new documentary that made specific references to a lot of things about Rose Sheremy, and I won't call his name. But he said, basically said, look, what written proof do you have that Rose knew and worked for Ruby and that she knew about the assassination plot in advance? And I'm happy to say that once I responded to him, I sent him quite a few documents, including the transcription of the testimony that Francis Frugier gave before the House Senate Assassinations Committee, that certainly satisfied and verified every question that he had about Mother's connection with Jack Ruby. Of course, we know Jack Ruby was completely involved with the mob. If I'm remembering correctly, I believe he was moved from Chicago to Dallas because the Chicago mob didn't like the fact that he had such a penchant for running drugs, selling drugs, et cetera. So they moved him to Dallas, certainly a place where he certainly continued that activity as a part owner of the club. But Rose was under his employ by this time in her life, not quite so much like her work at the Blue Angel when she was drop-dead gorgeous and made quite an appearance as a stripper in the Blue Angel. But she, by this time, she had become very valuable in an odd sort of way. I say valuable, but yet, in some ways, Mother was little more than trash to be taken out to the street, you know, by some things that I've discovered. So she was a mixture of being of value and at the same time.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second, because I want to add a little context to this that I don't know if you know at all about this or not, and I hope to discover it as I read through your book. But let me give you a couple things. First of all, Ruby got moved because he was attracting too much attention, and he got caught up in more than one case where there might have been a murder. And this was the problem. He was bringing down too much heat, and he's not a made guy, but he was useful to the outfit, and he got sent down there. Now, an interesting thing about what the mob was doing in that area, in Dallas, in Texas, a bunch of stuff that a whole lot of researchers just don't seem to pick up on, is that they had a very useful and lucrative business when it came to a combination of those strip clubs, prostitution, and, quite frankly, pornography, which is the thing that they never seem to pick up on, that there was a whole pornography business going on. You know, again, at the risk of, I know I'm not going to offend you, I've asked you this several times, but frankly, your mother's useful to all that. Then you combine the fact that she is also a bit fearless, apparently, according to descriptions, when it comes to a lot of circumstances. She's willing to deal with tough spots, not to be afraid. This also means she's a good, good drug runner. Why? Women are easier camouflage for drug running, especially if they're pretty women. And I got told that by, you know, guys who are in that business. You know, look, it's easier. You can do things with a pretty woman like this. And even if you do get a pinch somehow, it might be for prostitution or whatever, but that's no big deal. They'll let you go on that. You can get away with moving around a large quantity of more expensive merchandise than they are. By using them. So this is perfectly logical. And I also find it interesting that you found out about the pink door, which, again, seemed to be something that eluded a lot of researchers, I'll call them in air quotes, previously when it came to your mom. The fact is, I'm satisfied by documents I saw before your book that she knew Ruby. And frankly, again, The other weird thing, though, is you were talking about Oswald here, and I have never, and I'm probably going to discover it, but I've never seen enough proof to say that she was directly around him, unless you accept that, you know, she must have been, based on circumstances. Now, perhaps in your book, there's a bit of a different piece of proof here, but if that is true, then you have a nexus here that combines these two characters that, according to all official explanations, despite, you know, what the House Select Committee found in the late 70s and what the Warren Commission found, although they are two slightly different conclusions, I don't think either one of them conceded that Ruby and Oswald were familiar with each other at all. So, you know, this is more remarkable than I think people are going to give it credit for. But can you try and explain that a little bit, actually, about how it is that you're fairly certain that she knew Oswald also?
Yes. In fact, it mainly stems to her claim following. She was actually in an airplane with Francis Frugier. They were following up on some of Rose's claims about a big drug shipment out of that was coming into Galveston, et cetera, all of which was definitely confirmed. Rose, as this odd character, this heroin addict, prostitute, drug courier that worked for the mob and also worked on the side for the FBI and other law enforcement, you know, she saw a lot of things, you know. And she was a smart woman. I mean, she stayed alive in that world for a very long time. And she didn't do that by running her mouth off. But during this flight with Francis Frugier, all fully documented in a transcription to the House Senate Assassinations Committee, Rose looks down at a newspaper in one of the seats on the airplane. And she sees some kind of heading on the newspaper that implied that Ruby and Oswald didn't know each other, had no association with each other at all. And according to Frugier, Mother just breaks out in absolute laughter and said, you know, hell, they didn't only know each other, they've been shacking up with each other for years. Right. Now, you know, that's a direct quote from Francis Frugier before the House Senate Assassinations Committee. You know, we already know that Oswald frequented the Carousel Club along with all the Houston Police Department. Mm. Was there, worked at the club, and like I said before, she was one of those people who was seen and not seen. I don't think anybody worried a whole lot at this point in time about what was said around Rose, because she was already in some ways a member of the club. She was already woven into the fabric of that society. But we also know that Ruby, I believe, has been proclaimed as one who was bisexual. We know that Marina Oswald frequently complained about Oswald about Lee Harvey being sexually inadequate in their marriage, you know. And so all of this kind of adds up in my mind, you know, that Oswald and Ruby certainly knew each other, and other people way smarter than I can prove this, you know, on many levels, yourself, Gary Shaw, and others. But I'm very certain that Rose was familiar with both of them, more intimately with Ruby because she directly worked for him. But I believe Oswald was someone she would fully recognize if you walked into a room.
Okay, so pause there. And why am I asking you to pause? Because Frugier, he's on a flight. Now, who is Francis Frugier? Obviously, this is the part of the show where I ask questions I already know the answers to. But who is Francis Frugier? And let's be clear about the time period in which she's doing this, talking about this, making the declaration, which on one level, frankly, may have been partially due to the fact that she was... she was jonesing for a fix, frankly. She was a little bit out of it in the hospital and all that. And that all comes from, again, back around to the Oliver Stone movie, that all comes from this incident where she is abandoned by people she's working with, okay, at a certain point after some sort of altercation or argument, at a place called the Silver Slipper. This is a real situation that has come up, and people followed up on it and found out back in the 90s. People followed up, found out about it, found the bartender, and confirmed that this had actually occurred. This is not part of a legend. And she ends up on the road, walking down the road, and a man named Frank Odom hits her with a car. Not too badly, but hits her enough that he might have injured her a little bit, takes her to the hospital. Now, I'm not sure exactly how much she was injured or anything like that, because I haven't seen the hospital records. But apparently, and I'm trying to just shorten this up for people, apparently she starts telling people working at the hospital, listen, these guys are going to go kill Kennedy. And this is not Friday. This is not the day of the assassination. This is before. Okay, this isn't she saw it on the news and she's imagining that her compatriots were involved. This is before the assassination, and eventually Frugier is called upon to transfer her to another hospital because she doesn't have the ability to pay the bill, basically. And he's called upon to transport her somewhere else, and in the course of that transport, these conversations take place like the one you're talking about with the newspaper and all, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And just to clarify for your listeners a little bit more, we're talking about the fall of 1963, immediately, just a few days prior to President Kennedy being shot on the street in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas. And so as, to set the stage a little more fully, Rose, my mother, at the time, she was in the middle of a big drug run with the two men that you referred to. So they were making this huge run from Miami to Dallas. And Rose conferred to Jeremy, and we'll get to that conversation in a moment, you know, that these guys were, I think she said, Italians, kind of in a Texas drawl. And but most probably, we now know that these two men were Cuban / Hispanic. The two men who were later identified for sure, as you just said, by Lieutenant Francis Frigier, who spent his career working for the Louisiana State Police Narcotics Division, one of the most learned people in Louisiana about how to deal with people addicted to drugs, how to investigate claims, information from people like that. And Frigier and his partner, Ann Dischler, while they were working for Jim Garrison, actually went back to the Silver Slipper and conferred that the two men that we're talking about, who were with my mother, were identified as Sergio Arcacha Smith and Amelia Santana. Mm-hmm. These were two, I guess for lack of a better term, two bad guys.
Yeah, certainly were. And the fact that they were Cuban accounts for her mistaking them as Italian, honestly.
Exactly.
Yeah, and honest mistake is honest mistake. But fact is, these guys pop up in a bunch of different places if you're studying a whole bunch of things related to this case. So you're not just talking about two random guys, first of all. And secondly, she's talking about this before, once again, before the assassination takes place. So, you know, by the time she's reading that article on the plane there, this is obviously after Jack Ruby comes to national prominence, which means it's got to be at least Sunday night, if not, Monday. So this is long after, and she goes, oh, what a joke. These guys knew each other. I know that. That is exactly the kind of thing that you say if you're familiar with the situation. So I'm just saying that when you look at this story, it goes well beyond what they show in that movie, but honestly, it's not a bad depiction according to the facts that we wind up learning later that Garrison investigated, and later on, some actual real researchers went on the ground and followed up on it as well. So, you know, and the whole story with Odom and everything, the whole thing actually comes together. It sounds almost unbelievable, but, you know, again, when you go into the darker regions of this country, you will find some stories that seem almost unbelievable. And your mother is a lifetime of them in her fairly short life. So,
yeah.
Anyways, and I only say short in that, you know, it was shortened at a certain point, and maybe you want to get into that at some point here in this discussion if we have time. But let's continue, because here she is. She's this interesting character. Okay, so she's at this nexus. Where did you go from there with that story? I mean, did you follow up on it even more?
Well, I dug as deeply as I could into every document I could put my hand on so that I could understand the sequence, because what it presents about Rose Jeremy, to me, implies that she was at that incident. And that's not how it happened, but that's all the research that Oliver Stone had available to him at the time. You know, like you just discussed, I mean, Rose stops. Should they pull in to the Silver Slipper, and she's been on the road with Smith and Santana. Smith and Santana have been, you know, blowing their mouth about why they're headed to Dallas, you know, acting like really big dudes. They're going to go to Dallas and be a part of something that's going to kill the president. And it just so happens that they weren't worried about Rose hearing this, but Mother was listening up very carefully. And in the car, before they get to the Silver Slipper, they get in an argument about what these men are saying. And I find this very interesting because it leads me to remember that Mother knew right from wrong. You know, she might have had a hard time doing what was right all the time, but when it got down to it, she knew that what these men were talking about was horrible, and in her own way, she wasn't going to stand for it. So as they enter the Silver Slipper, they're mouthing, arguing, Mac Manuel, the manager of the bar, the club there, later confers to Frugier and Dischler that, yes, Santana and Smith came in with Rose Jeremy. They were arguing, and there was also a third person present, Jean-Paul Jeannette, who was the man who was actually thought to be Mother's primary pimp. And they're arguing, and Mother is in a really bad way. She really needs a heroin hit, and so she loses it in the club. And these two guys didn't think twice about taking control of her. And I can just imagine in my mind's eye what was going on in that club. Mother ranting and raving, cursing a blue streak. And these guys go, I don't think this is what's going to happen. They rough her up, throw her out the front door, and toss her into the gravel parking lot and leave her there. No one comes to her aid at all. And of course, they go back in the bar. They really don't give a crap. You know, like I said earlier, at times I felt like most people around her considered Mother little more than the trash that they could just toss out the door.
Well, see, that's the thing. She's helpful while she's helpful, but when she ain't, she's disposable. That's what the point is. And again, I'm not trying to be rude or nasty here. I'm just telling you what the reality is. If she's going to be helpful, great. If not, you can ditch her. You can get rid of her. In fact, the attitude might be that you could kill her. It would be okay.
Absolutely.
Nobody's going to, you know, the old phrase, nobody will miss her.
They don't care.
That would be the attitude. So the idea that they have an argument with her and just abandon her on the side of the road, you know, look, get the hell out of here. We're done with you.
Absolutely.
Is perfectly reasonable considering the situation. Now, it's funny that you make this discernment between, you know, look, here's right and wrong and here's right and wrong, because honestly, it's a weird kind of duality that exists in the criminal underworld in some cases, which a lot of people do not understand whatsoever. It's like, how can this guy care about anything if he's willing to do this, 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 this? And there's almost always a line where they say, look, you know, there's a reason why, you know, Lucky Luciano helped defend the ports during World War II. There's a line. There's a reason why, okay, that these guys will turn around and say, look, you can go this far, but you don't go over this line. Much like the general rule of, look, don't screw with the FBI guys. If they are not dirty, they're just doing their job. Let them do their job. They have limits. And a lot of people don't understand that because they think, oh, no, they're just a criminal. They couldn't possibly. So anybody who is involved in that world actually always has some sort of line. And look, nobody is exactly like everybody else, no matter what business you're in. So there are people that, yeah, I'm sure that they didn't care if a dollar was in it. Didn't matter. Didn't matter who got hurt or whatever else. But some of these guys have limits. And look, a dope runner and a prostitute also, guess what, has a limit. So she's fine with running dope. She's fine with, you know, whatever else. I'll take my licks. I'll take my beating when I have to and whatever else. And you know what? Some other people get hurt in the process, but this is the business we're in. But maybe this is too far where it's like, look, you guys are talking about doing something outside of the lines of what it is we do. And yeah, so that is a possibility. I mean, I'm not claiming to understand your mother's ethics. I'm just saying that it's possible that it's exactly as you describe where, yes, indeed, look, you know what? We can run dope. We can do this. We can steal. We can do whatever. But, you know what? You're going too far now. And
exactly.
That's
exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, we are talking about a different day. I mean, you know, killing the president, even talking about it openly, is against the law. You know, and here she is with two people who openly talk about knocking him off, and she's going, wait a minute. This can't happen. Maybe I'll do what I can. Honestly, I'm a little surprised that Rose wasn't eliminated right there at the Silver Slipper. I mean, after hearing what she heard from these two gentlemen, plus the Jean-Paul Jeanette character, I'm surprised they tossed her out and walked back into the club. You know, and as you said earlier, that's the point where Rose goes, fine, I'll do it on my own. I'll get to Dallas on my own. She stumbles out to the highway, and as you referenced earlier, she's probably stumbling back and forth across the road. She hasn't had her heroin hit. Maybe she had one too many beers trying to compensate. And she bumps into Frank Odom's vehicle, and according to his testimony, Mother's cussing a blue streak at him for bumping into her as he kindly makes her get in his car so he can take her into Eunice to the Musa Hospital where she can, you know, supposedly get some care.
Right.
And then what happens after that is just unbelievable, you know, that she gets they realize that Mother is not someone who can pay for this medical care, as you referenced. So this shows everything about addicts and drugs. We'll get him to take care of her. So they call him away from a special party that he's attending. He comes and looks at Rose and realizes that she's showing signs of major drug withdrawal. And she can't pay for anything. The only place that she can be taken to is the local jail. So he takes her to the Eunice jail. She continues to be going through a really painful situation. This is, you know, where when he comes back, he actually comes back a second time with a physician in tow to give Rose a sedative because she has literally ripped the clothes off of her body and is clawing at her skin because she is in such a bad way and in such a need for a heroin fix, and also banging her head up against the wall, Once the sedative takes hold and they get her calmed down, Frugier reports before the committee that, you know, they dress her and they make the decision to take her by ambulance to East Louisiana State Hospital for care. And it's during this trip that Mother begins to, babble, but she starts to come in and out of lucidity. And relays everything she knows from the men going to Dallas to kill the president, that she's going to Dallas on her own to pick up her son, me, and she's going to get $8,000 put in her hand for her part of this job, and the mob's going to put $29,000 in her hands to use to pick up a drug shipment that I said is coming in Galveston from a guy named Tony Vincent Malone, a heroin dealer and a club owner, you know, who is is alleged to have been directly associated with Jack Ruby. So, I mean, all of this starts spilling out to Frugier. And, you know, even as skilled as he was, I'm sure he's thinking in the back of his mind, this is crazy. Yet, in his learned perspective, he knows not to blow off everything that Mother's saying. But, of course, what really grabbed him is once he leaves her at East Louisiana State Hospital, he takes his leave. And, of course, we all know what happened to President Kennedy. And as soon as that happens, you know, he's pretty hot to trot to figure out a way to get back in touch with Rose because she actually predicted that the president was going to die.
Well, see, there's the thing. Again, back to this situation where somebody who is not familiar with this might say, that sounds crazy. She's stripping off her clothes and scratching at her skin. Well, if you think that's surprising, then you've never been familiar with what a heroin addict who is withdrawing does. Because they do some pretty out-of-control things. And will say a lot of things. Now, Prouget, because he's an experienced narcotics officer, is going to be aware that, first of all, you know, they'll try and deal with a narcotics officer. You know, get me a hit, I'll tell you anything. And all that. I'm sure some of that was going on in the back and forth there, which might have not been preserved in records. You know, get me a fix and I'll do whatever.
Right.
Desperation comes in. But in the meantime, she's probably throwing out all kinds of things out of her mouth that if she was, you know, straight, so to speak, with her chemical balance, she would probably be a lot more quiet about. But she was blurting out all sorts of things. And he's got to parse that out. Because sometimes, honestly, you know, it's not like a heroin addict has to be a liar. They could be telling you some of the truth. They could be telling you some of the things they're imagining, even, because the withdrawal is pretty brutal and does things to your mind as you're going through it. And in 1963, frankly, they didn't have as many pharmaceutical solutions or things to balance somebody out or to stabilize them. Yeah, a sedative would have probably been the best they could have done, short of giving her something that would have fed her drug addiction. Which would have straightened her out. So this all is a very real story, and some people have discounted it over the years because, well, come on, you know, this woman is who she is. So, but I point again to that thing that is mouthed by Kevin Costner, which Jim Garrison said several times in interviews and everything. I have no idea why a woman who is a prostitute has to have bad eyesight, which, you know, effectively means they can't be bad witnesses all the time. And just because that's the business they're in doesn't mean that they're liars either. So, you know, he's got to kind of parse this out. And the fact that this is, now I want to turn back to you if you don't mind. Because when did you discover this story? I mean, when did you actually, you know, give me the point in time where it's like, wait a minute. Not only, you know, I know who my mother is, but that's my mother who's doing that. Who did that, obviously at a time when you were much younger, and now, well, even though she was supposed to be coming back to get you, you know, what is it, when is it that you actually discover that this whole series of events occurred?
Yes, it has been a long process, but it is all precipitated mainly by the day that I met Gary Shaw and his cohort, Joe West, who, you know, anyone who's studied the Kennedy assassination probably recognizes both of those names. Joe West, now deceased, Gary Shaw, still alive and well in Texas, and recognized as, you know, certainly one of the top two or three minds in the world related to knowing about the Kennedy assassination. I think Gary has spent over 60 years of his life researching, trying to get to the bottom line about what happened that day. But it's sometime, see, I was rethinking today the date that I met Gary Shaw and Joe West. It was sometime in the middle 70s, around 1975 or so. And the reason I know that is because I was a young student at Baylor University. I had not finished my degree. It was about a year away. And I got a mysterious phone call from my aunt, Moselle Wall, saying that she and her husband, Morris, had received a phone call from a man named Gary Shaw and Gary West. And they said that they had some really important information to tell our family about my mother. And he made a specific request that if they had access to me, that they would really like for me to be present at the meeting. Long story short, my relatives communicate that to me. A date is set. I drive from Waco up to North Dallas in Farmers Branch and go to my aunt's home, where I'd been many times as a child. And we meet these two gentlemen, and then they literally very carefully start to unravel some of this story. Now, I think it's important to know that my aunt and uncle as were all of our family members as adults, were very familiar with the troubled life that Mother had led. But I guarantee you, nobody had any idea or any anticipation for what was about to be unloaded on us by Gary Shaw. Mm. And that was exactly the tale that we've been talking about a little bit here. Of course, you know, Mother's tale is gargantuan in scope. Right. You know, sometimes people look at me and say, could you please just give me the short version of this? And, you know, and I just laugh inside because there is no short version. But anyway, Gary Shaw and Joe begin to unravel this. I can remember to this day that my aunt and uncle were absolutely stunned. Yes, did they realize that Mother's life is troubled? Yes. Did they realize that she walked in this world, in this unseen world that you've referred to two or three times in our show? No. Did they know that she had trouble with drugs and alcohol? Yes. Did they know that she was a courier and a professional organizer of prostitutes for the mob? No. They had no idea. Did they know she was an informant for the FBI? And even people like worked closely with Lieutenant Billness or in the Houston Police Department in the early 50s. No, they didn't know any of this. But among the most tragic things that Gary revealed to us in that meeting was that Mother was definitely not killed as a result of an automobile accident at the hands of Jerry Don Moore on September 4, 1965. You know, that's been the big cover-up that I have come to believe with every fiber of my being, that the big cover-up was that Mother was run over on September 4, 1965, on Highway Farm to Market Road 155 out in the middle of nowhere outside of Gladewater, Texas. Right. And when it gets right down to it, what's discovered in the medical records that I uncovered at Gladewater Hospital was that Mother actually had a very unusual wound to her head that in this 20-plus page document is described in the first three or four sentences of this medical report. And it lists this wound as a punctate stellate wound. You know, and over the years, I probably talked to a dozen physicians and handed them this document and said, please read this and tell me what you think is being described here. And every one of them referred to this as most likely being a gunshot, a close-range gunshot wound to Mother's temple. Well, my family had no clue about this. I mean, in fact, they were so convinced that Jerry Don Moore had run over Mother that they went at him full bore. And, you know, they did all kinds of things to Jerry Don Moore to, quote, unquote, punish him for killing their daughter and sister, when in the long run, Jerry Don Moore was an angel, a Samaritan, you know, who actually offered Mother a chance at living in the wake of this punctate stellate wound to her head. You know, so, I mean, you can imagine that my aunt and my uncle and I were reeling from this revelation. You know, I admit that as a young man, of, let's see, 1976, I'm 22 years old, 23 years old, I really didn't get the entire picture. Right. My aunt and uncle probably saw everything much more clearly, and my guess is that the entire scenario broke their heart even more than their hearts had already been broken over the years about Mother. But it was definitely that day that the seed was planted. But it didn't really take full impact until years later, okay, till I was in my early 30s, when I started really digging and researching. And honestly, I hadn't even looked into the grocery sacks that I told you about in the first hour that had all the documents and the handwritten letters and the death certificate, which is full of contradictions. I mean, the death certificate itself is stamped DOA three times. And almost every grown adult know that means dead on arrival. Mm-hmm. as in not breathing. Yet the medical report that I was able to unearth with my lawyer and the help of Gary Shaw has detailed notations about mother receiving care at the Gladewater Municipal Hospital for 8.5 hours, including the setting of a broken forearm. To state the obvious, you don't set the broken forearm with someone who's DOA. So all I'm trying to say is that on that day in my aunt and uncle's living room, 3633 High Vista in North Dallas, a whole world about mother was opened up to me, and it actually took me decades to unravel.
No, and I fully appreciate this, and I'm going to ask this question. I don't know if this is revealed in the book or not, but photographic records could have been taken of certain things at the time. Were there any photographs in any of the files that you've been able to unearth? The reason why I'm asking is because, quite honestly, in investigating my own father's death, the photographs, although very, very hard to view, allowed me to... actually clean up the mess that the authorities made out of his death, which, by the way, I wound up with the same conclusion. I didn't wind up with the murder conclusion that my aunt had told me. And, you got to remember also that family members, when they're affected by a death, I see you speculate about what might have been in their heads, about what it is they wanted to face and whatever. It is so much more complex. Then, I had one aunt telling me that my father was murdered. I had another telling me that they had no idea what the hell had happened when she did know what happened. All kinds of mess, trying to unearth these things years later and trying to go back through files that people don't want to let out of their hands, even though they have them there. And you are the surviving, offspring of the individual that you want to see these things. Not easy to pry out of people's hands. A lawyer and Gary Shaw, you had some angels there assisting you. But I'm curious if there were any photographs as we come down to the last couple of minutes here, because they may have been highly revelatory regarding what actually happened as well. Was there anything like that you were able to discover from the incident that led to her death?
Well, I was able to prove with documentation and through newspaper articles about the incident that in the wake of her death, medical authorities indeed ordered the state of Texas to conduct a thorough autopsy. Vital organs were sent to Austin for analysis, etc. We know that the autopsy was done, but the autopsy records themselves have never seen the light of day. No one has ever been able to unearth those, not even Gary Shaw. And so I thoroughly believe that that specific document could have shed a lot of information on the particulars about this situation. And I don't believe anyone wanted those documents to be seen. The other interesting fact about all of this is when my family was notified that mother was indeed dead, lying in the Gladewater Hospital, which it's a miracle that they even knew who mother was. Mm-hmm. Mother never traveled with identification when she was doing these drug couriering, prostitution tours, if you will, for the mob. She went without any identification for obvious reason whatsoever. But miraculously, there were three suitcases that were stuck in the middle of the road, positioned to pull an oncoming car to Mother's body on Highway 155. Aunt Jerry Don Moore, after he actually took Mother to the hospital, it'd take 30 minutes to discuss that scene, but long story short, he actually stopped. Gets mother off of the highway, takes her to a doctor in the middle of the country. The doctor realizes he can't do anything for her. They rush her to Gladewater Hospital in an ambulance. Jerry Don Moore realizes she's getting the best care she possibly can, and he goes back to the scene. He drives back to the scene, sees the suitcases, gathers them up, and if he hadn't done that, no one would have ever discovered the one thing that would have identified Mother immediately, and that was a letter from her mother with the return address of Youngbloods, and that's how they actually tracked the family dad down to inform them that their daughter and their sister was dead. And at that time, I'll never forget my uncle relaying that, actually my aunt told me about this, that my uncle, Uncle Morris, was the one given the task of driving from Dallas to Gladewater to identify the body. But oddly, when he got into the hospital to identify his sister-in-law, someone at the hospital said, look, somebody has already been here and identified this body. So, and it claimed someone who claimed to be a red-haired cousin of the Youngblood family. Huh. And to this day, we have never been able to figure out who that red-headed cousin. You know, honestly, though I can't prove it without a shadow of a doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt, I believe someone needed to check and make sure that Rose was dead. Hmm. And so somebody got sent to that hospital. But again, to answer your question, yes, a formal autopsy was requested by authorities, and that report has never been shared with our family. We've never seen the results of that. And, of course, those documents can't be found at all.
Well, I'm almost speechless at that because, frankly, I could tell you, again, long story short, I basically had to threaten a medical examiner to get access to to the file I wanted. Not saying I would suggest that to anybody, but I was at wit's end about it. And frankly, since I knew it was there, I went after it. But again, my story is not like yours, and I don't think anybody's is. Again, there's a lot of similarities that you could find in, I'm satisfied to say, 100,000 stories, probably like Rose Sheremy's in a way. But but the fact that she was at a particular crossroads that wound up having her meet Jack Ruby, very likely run into Lee Harvey Oswald, and the idea that she was predicting ahead of time what was going to happen on November 22nd, 1963. Of course, that is the point of interest that most people would come into your mother's story. But I guarantee you'll learn a lot more and be exposed to, again, a piece of the invisible part of America, which I assure you, you the listener, is something that still lives and breathes to this day, despite the fact that Rose Sheremy died under rather odd circumstances. I've always known that part of it. I think 1965, I would advise anybody listening to this who is interested to get the second edition, okay, of Michael Marchetti's book, which we have talked about now for 2 hours. And sadly, we have not given you a full explanation in 2 hours about what's in this book. I've done my best to encapsulate it and to give you a rough estimate of what it is you might discover. But the book is Rose Sheremy, Gathering Fallen Petals. The second edition, I advise you to get. Michael Marchetti's, who has been my guest, who is Rose Sheremy's son, was talking with us and opening up, frankly, for the past 2 hours. So get the book, follow up. I'll give you the links in the show description. Michael, I want to thank you for doing this with me.
Chuck, what a pleasure. You know, every time I have the opportunity to talk about Mother, I always, and I actually mean this, I always feel just a little bit closer to her. And that's what this road of research was for me. You know, I wasn't trying to answer a long list of questions for Kennedy assassination researchers. I was trying to learn who my mother was and uncover every possible detail about her life. And sure, of course, as it intersects with Kennedy, but it's the big picture of her life as my mother that has always been the calling part of this. So I appreciate so much the opportunity to talk with you tonight.
Well, we appreciate you, and I hope people appreciate this book because it is a unique work, and it is, again, an honest and deep, real piece of research done, again, for a personal reason, but we all get to benefit from the enlightenment that you provide in here. Again, Michael Marchetti's my guest, And thank you all for listening, because after all, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.